Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, approximately. If you'd like to be on the program and are listening to the live broadcast, then that's an opportunity that exists for you. If you have a question about anything related to the Bible or Christianity, or you have a difference of opinion from the host and would like to express that, feel free to call me today. We've got about an hour together, and right now our lines are all open. It's not always the case, and probably won't be the case again any time later in the program. So if you'd like to take the opportunity to get through, you can get through now. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. If you'd like to be on the program today, those lines are open. And I want to make an announcement for those who sometimes or regularly attend our meetings in Aptos on Thursday night. If you're listening and you attend our Thursday night meeting, I need to make an announcement. We have not had time to get this on the internet. There's a last-minute cancellation of this week's meeting, tomorrow night, that is. Tomorrow night's meeting in Aptos is not going to be happening, and that is because our host family have become grandparents again, and their daughter is recovering from a birth, and so grandparents are taking care of the other grandkids, and we'll simply not be able to host the meeting tomorrow night, but we'll be back on schedule again the next week. So if you are an attender of the Thursday night meetings in Aptos, please take note, there's no meeting there tomorrow night. And if you know somebody who else attends and may not be listening, you may want to contact them and let them know too. All right, that's the main announcement for this week, and that is that, I guess it's just a cancellation. I've got my lines lighting up. I have one line that is not yet lighting up, so if you'd like to take that line, the number is 1-800-438-5090. Let's talk to Kyle, calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota, first of all, today. Hi, Kyle. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me. I was just listening to your spiritual warfare series, and you mentioned hypnosis briefly, and you said you didn't know too much about it, and I was just calling to offer just a little bit of insight and then maybe get your comments on it.
Okay.
Before I was a Christian, I actually wanted to be a regressive hypnotherapist. I don't know if you've ever heard that term, but the belief is that, you know, there's hypnosis. Therapists that are taking people back into their childhood, while aggressive hypnotherapists would be taking them back into, quote-unquote, their past lives.
And I assumed that that was what that label meant. Go ahead.
Yeah. So obviously I had to confront this when, you know, early in my Christian walk and understand what it was all about. And like a lot of the books that I read before I was a Christian that kind of developed what I believed were dictated by people supposedly in their past lives through the process of hypnosis.
Mm.
But since becoming a Christian, I've come to believe that that process is really just one and the same, but with psychological labels of trances or mediumship.
Okay.
I don't think in every circumstance with hypnosis it's that way, but I think with this particular one it is, because when the person goes into this trance, and then they're supposedly talking to a person who lived in Egypt or something. Their demeanor changes. They start acting like a different person. Their tone of their voice changes. All these things change like you would expect in a medium channeling someone. And the person, of course, can offer insights and things that were actually true and can be validated from sage in Egypt or wherever else. But, you know, demons are privy to that information. And also, the person in hypnosis, you know, you go into these exercises like deep breathing and other things, very similar to the exercises one goes into when they're trying to go into a trance. And so anyway, I've personally come to that conclusion that when a person is reporting all this information in a deep trance or in a deep hypnosis, they're really just a demon is coming through and saying all these things.
Well, I think that's entirely possible. I don't know for sure, but I know that that in Deuteronomy chapter 18, it lists a lot of occult practices that are forbidden to Israel. And one of the things mentioned is a charmer. And I'm not really sure what a charmer was, but I've heard from commentators several times in my past that it's essentially the same thing as a hypnotist. It was a charmer. That's a King James word, charmer. I don't know what the modern translations would use for that word, but it does seem possible that the word hypnotist is implied by that word, and if so, then it is definitely against that. Scripture is against it.
Sure. Well, actually, it's interesting. I tried to have hypnotisms done and stuff before I became a Christian, and after becoming a Christian, it was quickly recognized that I was demonized myself. And so I can't prove this all for sure, but that's the conclusion I've come to, given my personal experience and my understanding. So I just wanted to offer that comment.
Okay, I appreciate your insights.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that, Kyle.
All right, well, have a nice day.
You too. Bye now.
Bye.
All right. Well, of course, I know that hypnosis is also used for medical purposes and for helping people quit smoking and things like that. I don't know if all hypnosis is the same. It certainly seems that those who are hypnotized and a different personality comes out of them, alleging to be from a past life and so forth, that's fairly easy for me to believe that that's a demonic experience. I don't know if all hypnotism is the same, and therefore I can't say much about it. I don't know very much about hypnotism. But if it's something that just helps people quit smoking, I don't know if it's a different process or if it's the same thing. Perhaps people who know more about that than I do may want to balance comment on that. Let's talk to Manuel in Albany, Oregon next. We have lines open for you also. If you'd like to call, the number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Manuel, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Steve, for taking my call. Peace be with you. I had a conversation with Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah.
And it makes me think about if the enemy, I'm talking about the devil, if he knew that Jesus Christ was a man. Do you remember the story of the person who was full of demons that Jesus asked, who's your name? And he says, the Legion, because we are so many. And they recognized Jesus Christ as the son, or I can't remember exactly. And
they recognize him as the Son of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if the enemy knew that he was the Son of God, why he tried to kill Jesus, he knew he was not going to be accomplished that purpose, if he knew. But if he didn't knew, that's what he would try to do if Jesus wasn't the flesh only.
Yeah, well, I think that it was no doubt the fact that the devil did know that Jesus was the Son of God is probably the reason that he was interested in killing him. Now, he didn't know about the resurrection, I think. I don't think he knew that Jesus would rise from the dead, but that was God's little secret. I believe that the devil saw that the Son of God had come to earth as a man and was therefore mortal and simply saw killing him as the devil's opportunity to get rid of him. Now, I don't know very much about how much the devil understood. We know that the demons did recognize Jesus as the Son of God, so if the demons did, then Satan certainly would have too. In fact, the devil, when he tempted Jesus in the wilderness, said, if you are the Son of God, turn these rocks into bread. Well, I don't think the devil was saying, if you are, and I doubt it. I think he was saying more like, since you are the Son of God, do this. But to say that the devil knew that Jesus was the Son of God, that doesn't mean that he knew that Jesus would rise from the dead. The disciples recognized Jesus as the Son of God also, and sometimes said so. Remember at Caesarea Philippi, Peter said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And yet Peter didn't know that Jesus would rise from the dead when Jesus died. So the resurrection of the dead is something we only know about looking backward at the event. People before the event didn't know that it would happen. And the devil, I think, didn't know that either.
Oh, I see. So Well, the reason I'm asking this question is because every time we have a conversation with them, we don't agree. They say the Jehovah is the real thing, and Jesus Christ is, and I always see.
It looks like my connection cut out. I don't know if, okay, can you hear me, Manuel? Okay, I can't hear you, and I don't know what happened. It feels like my connection, it kind of sounds like my connection cut out, so I don't even know if I'm still connected to the radio station, but I've lost connection with you, Manuel, and I don't want to lose, I'd like to continue talking with you, so I don't know why I'm not hearing you. Call screener, am I still on the air there? Is that possible for you to let me know? Okay, I'm going to assume that I am, and I'll talk to you, Manuel, about the Jehovah's Witnesses. They believe that you must talk to God as Jehovah, because God's name is revealed as Jehovah, or really more properly, not Jehovah, but four letters, J-H-V-H, or it can be translated Y-H-V-H, in the Old Testament, the name of God. And so they feel like we have to use that name of God because it's in the Bible. Well, it is in the Bible. It is in the Old Testament. But we don't have anywhere in the New Testament that teaches us that we are to refer to God by that name. Jesus never said that we should call God by that name. The disciples who wrote the New Testament did not say that we should call God by that name. And therefore, I don't really know that we could say that we should. Necessarily. I don't think there's anything wrong with calling God Jehovah. I mean, if people want to call him Jehovah, that's fine with me, as long as they don't neglect to address him the way that Jesus said to address him. And that way was, of course, Jesus told us to address him as the Father. He said, when you pray, say, Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Now, my call screen tells me I'm still on the air, so I'm assuming people are listening, but I don't know why Manuel got cut off. His phone line seems to be still activated, unless my screen is lying to me. I'll disconnect him there. And now I don't have any calls waiting. So if you want to give me a call, I think it's possible that Manuel's phone just got cut off. So just go ahead and give me a call. 1-800-438-5090. If you'd like to be on the air today, it's a slow day for calls. A good day to get on. 1-800-438-5090. I want to tell you about our website, because I often don't have time to do so. I'm watching the switchboard now as calls start to come in and drop off, too. I'm not sure if we're having trouble with our phone lines, but keep trying, please, because we do want to talk to you. 1-800-438-5090. Our website is another resource besides this radio program that you may be interested in. In fact, it's got a lot more going for it than the radio program, because it has the radio program at it. You can listen to the radio program live or later from our website, or you can listen to hundreds of past radio programs going back. I think there's a year's programs are archived on the site. Plus, there's hundreds of MP3 files of lectures that I've given when I was teaching at the Great Commission School in Oregon. I taught through the Bible many times, and we have my entire teaching, verse by verse, through the whole Bible there for free download, and also lectures I gave on hundreds of different topics. When I say hundreds, I'm not exaggerating. There's probably about 300 different topics and about 600 lectures through the Bible, if I recall correctly. So there's a lot of free resources. There's nothing for sale. You don't even have to sign up. We won't ever get your name or your email address or contact you or spam you or do anything like that. It's just free resources. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Okay, I'm going to see if we can have our phones operating properly here. We've got a call from, looks like Quesha in Las Vegas, if I'm not reading the...
Hello?
Hello, yes. How do you pronounce your name?
Quesha.
Quesha, okay, then that's correct. Welcome.
Hi. You know, actually, I just found your radio station yesterday, and I was just trying to substitute it with something different in my car. But my question is, I have two wonderful, awesome pastors who are great, but I'm trying to find a balance in between dealing with church and then dealing with my family who's not saved and in the world, like someone that I can, someone that I'm involved with is not saved. And how do you deal with that balance?
Well, you're trying to find a balance between church and your unsaved relatives or unsaved
yes.
friends?
Yes.
Well, where is the problem? Is it, do your friends object to you going to church, or is it that you don't have enough time for both, for church and your friends?
I don't have enough time. When we go to talk, I look at it differently now, and it's not the same. And it's like tearing apart between us all. You know, it's like I don't do the things I used to do now.
Sure. Are you the only Christian in your family?
No, me and my sister.
I see. Well, the truth is, of course, once you become a Christian, Jesus does become your priority. And the ideal is that you can still maintain all of your friendships with your non-Christian friends as much as they will be permitted, and with your family as much as they'll permit it. But if they don't permit it, there actually comes a time in some people's lives where they have to follow Jesus at the cost of their relationships with their friends and families. It should never be, in my opinion, it should not be that you should cut off your relationship with them unless they are extremely hostile and extremely tending to drag you down. I mean, if they're trying to drag you away from Christ, then you might have to break off your relationship with them. But they might break off their relationship with you if you keep loyal to Christ. The main thing is that being loyal to Christ is what being a Christian means. And therefore, doing what a Christian should do is something that you must do, even if it means you don't have the kind of relationship you'd like to have with other people who don't approve. Now, going to church is another thing. Going to church isn't the same thing as following Jesus, though Christians do generally go to church or at least seek fellowship with other Christians somewhere. Now, are you spending a lot of time at church so that you don't have time for your friends and family anymore? Is that the complaint? How often do you go to church?
Sundays and Wednesdays, you know,
okay.
And that's about it.
Well, that's not excessive. Have you invited your friends to go with you?
I invite, and I get laughed at, and it's like, yeah, right about the situation. And the thing is, I want the person to come so that way our relationship could develop, because if not, then I can't be with that person.
So this is a person you're dating or someone you're in
yes.
that kind of relationship with? Okay. And so the real problem here is that person is opposed to you going to church and opposed to you following Christ?
He says he's not opposed, but don't bring it to him. And then when I'm talking to him about it, it's really like shut the blank up or get the out of my face. I don't want to hear it, and I can't. And it hurts. It honestly hurts my spirit.
Sure. Well, I understand that. Now, did you become a Christian recently, or have you been a Christian for a long time?
A year ago.
Mm-hmm. And was this relationship happening before you were a Christian, and it's changed because you became one, or did you meet this man after you were a Christian?
No. He's been around now for quite some time.
For years. And so he resents the changes that have happened in your relationship with him since you've become a Christian. Is that
right?
Correct.
Or else he'll tell me, oh, it's phony, it's not real, this will die off soon. And it's like, why would you say that?
Yeah, I think that's what you should say.
But is it true in the Bible, if you praise God enough and you worship him, he will eventually save that person?
It can happen. It can happen. The Bible doesn't promise that. But it has often happened that people have been led to the Lord through friends that they were in relationships with. I would just say you need to take a courageous stand and say, well, I've decided to follow Jesus, and I'd be very happy if you wanted to follow Jesus with me. But Jesus is real. He's real to me, and he's real objectively. He's a real God. He's the real God. And if your friend laughs, I'd just say, well, you know, maybe you could tell me what's so funny about that. You know, I mean, if he's laughing, he's probably trying to intimidate you, probably trying to make you feel foolish. Well, he's the one who's being foolish. Ask him what's so funny about it. You know, he probably won't have anything good to say. That is, he probably won't have a valid answer. But I would just put him on the defensive. If he's trying to put you on the defensive, I'd just say, listen, I've made a commitment to Christ. I feel like it's I think it's benefiting my spiritual life for me to attend church on Sunday and Wednesdays. That certainly is not excessive. I mean, there's people who go to AA meetings every day of the week, and they don't think that's excessive. There's certainly nothing wrong with getting together with Christians for spiritual encouragement twice a week or more. So it doesn't sound like your church involvement is so extraordinarily demanding that it would prevent you from continuing to have friendships outside the church. But if he's jealous that, if this is a romantic relationship that you have with him, and if he's jealous because you now are sharing your heart with Jesus and divided, well, that jealousy is either going to lead him to become a Christian or probably to look for some other woman, you know.
Right.
And if he looks for some other woman and if your relationship with him ends, that'll probably feel bad to you. But when you think about it, if you're going to follow Jesus the rest of your life, and of course that's what you plan to do as a Christian, then it's probably just as well that somebody who won't do that with you reveals that as early as possible so you can look elsewhere.
Right.
So I would say between the two, your loyalty is first to Christ. If you can maintain, you know, positive relationships with people outside the church as well, that's, I think it's a good idea. Although I don't know what I would say that you need to be cautious about continuing a relationship of a romantic sort with someone who doesn't become a Christian, and especially if they're hostile to you being a Christian. It may be that breaking up with them will be inevitable. And it may be that it's the right thing to do. I'm not sure. I don't know if you will be able to lead this person to Christ. But if he's going to be hostile, if he's going to make jokes about it, if he's going to oppose you, then it might be necessary. Hard as it would be, I'm sure, for you. But it might be necessary if you just say, well, I'm sorry, you know, I'm following Jesus. I'm sorry you don't respect me enough to respect my decision. But that's what I'm going to do. And if it's not going to work out with us because of that, then I guess we should go separate ways.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm sorry that you have to make that kind of decision. That, you know, a lot of people, when they become Christians, have similar dilemmas that they face. In fact, in some parts of the world, when a person becomes a Christian, their own family wants to kill them in a Muslim family or something like that. You know, I mean, so it's a little less difficult for us here, but there's always some sacrifice to make for God. Because the world is against us. The world is against God. And if we decide to be on God's side, then the world that's against God is going to be against us as well.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Is there any verses or anything that you could, you know, recommend that I read?
Yeah, there are. I would suggest if you read, for example, in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus is telling his disciples that they will receive opposition from even their family members. Now, in this case, it may not be your family member, but a friend. But what is true of family members would here also apply to a friend. Jesus said this in Matthew 10, verse 34, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword." He means division between people. There's going to be the result of people following him. They'll end up being divided. Even though they may not wish to be, they will end up being divided from former relations. He says, "For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes will be those of his own household. But he who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me." Now, what Jesus is saying is that if you are going to follow Jesus, there will be times when even your relatives may stand against you. And if they do, you have a hard choice to make. Do I love my relatives more or do I love Jesus more? And he said, it's going to have to be me. It's going to have to be me, he said. Now, in another place, in Matthew 19, verse 29, Jesus said, "Everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or lands for my name's sake shall receive a hundredfold and shall inherit everlasting life." Now there he's talking about if you're following Jesus and you, in doing so, you have to sacrifice treasured relationships, including with family members. And that would include friends that you love too. Well, God knows that you've made that sacrifice. He's not unaware of that, and there will be a recompense for that. Jesus said you receive 100-fold more. That's probably an exaggeration of sorts, what we call a hyperbole, but he's saying that it'll be made up to you more than what you've given up, believe it or not.
Well, I thank you very much.
Okay, Quasha, I appreciate you calling.
All right, you have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, we're going to talk next to Skip calling from Marina, California. Skip, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
I always enjoy your program. It's a wonderful program. God bless you and everybody who listens. About 3.5 months ago, you guys did some wonderful prayer for me on the radio, and I popped right out of a depression I'd been in a long time.
Praise God.
Yes, yes. And all of you who did pray, too. I met this lady, and I've been celibate about 17 years, and I fell terribly in love with her. And it just seemed like the most wonderful thing that had happened to me in all this time. And we're hitting rocky traveling. It's up one day in heaven, and then it's 2 days in hell, and it just keeps going up and down like that. And yesterday we had a really major blow-up, and she confessed that she is in love with me, as I have been in love with her for a long time. And I was hoping I would like it if I'm Skip and she's Arabella. I had her name on there before when she listened to your program. I would love it if everyone would pray that the right thing happens between us. If God wishes to spare our love, that he do so, and we have a happy Christian marriage. And if not, whatever. She's gone to church with me a couple times, but she says she's not a Christian and not really interested in going that way, although she just has a whole lot of... She's more Christian in her actions than mostly I am. And I'm one of those guys that goes to AA every day, by the way, and
uh-huh.
Listen to your program and read the Bible every day. I benefit from all the above. And
well,
that's about it there.
Okay, we will, I and others will be praying that your relationship will go as it should. I want to say this, though, too, that I don't know what kind of conflicts are happening. You say you're having them every few days or something. If they are very serious conflicts already.
Yesterday was.
Yeah, you need to be careful not to get married in a situation where you're already having this kind of conflicts, because usually getting married doesn't solve them.
I have terrific insecurities from early childhood abandonment, and this stuff comes up with me a lot. She has a lot of time spent into her life. We're both in our 60s, going on 16 years old in maturity, and she has a lot of life that she keeps going on her own. I often feel like I'm just getting short shrift for time, And I have terrible insecurities that drive me into jealousy and anger. I finally told her I'm going to start therapy of some kind today.
Well, Skip, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
You say you're getting short shrift from her time. What is she doing with her time that you think she should be with you with? I mean, does she have no spare time? Is she working a lot? How come she doesn't have the time to be with you?
She's got many friends, organizations she's involved in with humanitarian concerns, and
uh-huh.
She takes photography classes. She's working on becoming an award-winning photographer,
that helps. That helps. Let me just say this.
Yeah.
She's quite educated.
She like me, got the 60s total treatment, except she went to academia. She has a master's degree.
Uh-huh.
But of course, that back then in the 60s, it was would be propagandizing more than education.
Yeah. Okay, Skip, I need to say some things here,
yeah,
to you, and my lines are full. But
please do, and I'll shut up.
Oh well, I was just going to say that when you are in love with somebody, it's often difficult to see the signs that things may not really be right. And I know this because I've been in love before.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been in love with people who weren't right for me. Now, they were always Christians. I've never been in love with a non-Christian in my life, but I've been in love with Christians who were not compatible with me. And one of the ways that became evident was that there was, you know, they had other things they'd rather do, you know, than be with me. And I don't blame them. I mean, there's no reason why someone should necessarily prefer to be with me than doing something else. But the thing is, it's an indicator that if they'd rather be spending time doing with their friends and stuff than with you, then perhaps their love for you, no matter how much they say they have love for you, it may not be what you're looking for in a partner. I mean, especially if you've got insecurity issues and jealousy and so forth.
I do.
You don't want to marry somebody who's going to continually jerk that chain by hanging out with other people and not being available to you and so forth. Now, there's no reason why she should have to be with you. There's no fault in it. It's just that, you know, if she doesn't want to be, it's good reason to think that she might not be the partner that you look for. It might be good to just stay friends, but not consider marriage.
I've never been able to be friends with a woman I fell in love with.
Yeah, I understand. I understand very well. But in which case it might be better to not even remain friends if she doesn't have the same commitment to you that you're looking for and that you want to have to her. And also, of course, the fact that she says she doesn't really want to go in the direction of becoming a Christian. I understand it's awfully hard in your 60s or even me in my 50s. It's hard to find, you know, people who are committed to Christ, who are solid Christians and who are single and, you know, interested in relationships and so forth. And, I mean, in my case, I know lots of women who are committed to Christ, but not necessarily compatible with me. Mm. In your case, you might know a lot of people who are a little more compatible with you and may not be committed to Christ. I don't know.
I get more of that.
Yeah. But the point is, you got to have both. You got to have both.
Yeah.
And if she's not committed to Christ, even if she's in love with you, even if she doesn't want to be with her friends as much as she wants to be with you, if she's not committed to Christ, there will be things about you that she will not appreciate and will not understand and will not sympathize with. There will be values that you have. There will be priorities that you have that she will not share. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're in love with someone who's not a Christian, you probably think, well, you know, if we just keep together, she'll become one. She'll become one.
Yeah.
But it sounds like she's already told you she's not interested in going that direction.
She's been pretty frank about that.
Yeah. Well, see, a lot of people who are not Christians would never say that. They would never say, well, no, I don't want to go in the direction of Christianity. They may not be Christians, but they don't know whether they want to or not eventually. But if she says she knows she doesn't want to be a Christian, I would say that should be a huge red flag to you,
although, you know, there was no one who was a more 25 years ago. There was no one who was more of a belligerent hater of Christianity than I.
Yeah. And, well, she could change.
Yeah.
She could change, but I would suggest that that you should not have your hopes very high until she does.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
All right. I'm going to ask our listeners to be praying for you, I'm glad to hear you came out of the depression.
Yeah, you guys it had to be like a miracle. I mean, it was the very next day.
That's great. Praise God.
And may I add one thing here?
All right.
I've been around the corner. I've been married several times, et cetera. But I've never walked down the street and held a woman's hand that her hand did more for me than many of the wild things I've done. But just holding her hand, it's like if our bodies don't love each other, there's something wonderful going on there.
Yeah, well, brother, I can understand that. I can. All I'm saying is strong feelings like that can often block your objectivity.
Yeah.
And one thing I learned, I've been married more than once, too.
Yeah.
And I've never married, ever.
You had a rep going, no.
Well, I've never married anyone except committed Christians.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the people I married were committed Christians.
Wow.
But I assumed that, hey, I'm a committed Christian, she's a committed Christian. What cannot work?
Yeah, sounds good.
Well, what cannot work is
unless
there's a lot of areas.
Unless they were born in California.
Well, they were born in California, but the thing is, what didn't work was they didn't have the same priorities. I mean, they seemed to during courtship, but then eventually they didn't. And you know, when that happens, compatibility becomes an issue. Now I would never divorce, but I lived in a very difficult situation with one
that.
Wife and then another because of different priorities. Yeah, so
yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, well, you feel in love when you're getting married to someone.
Yeah.
You do so because you're in love with them and you feel like, hey, love will cover up all the problems that could come up. But what I find is that love, the emotion of love tends to come and go. I should say it rises and falls. I'm not saying it ever has to go away completely, but there's times when you feel overwhelmingly in love, and there's times when you just feel mildly in love. And at those times when you're not overwhelmingly in love, sometimes you look more objectively and say, you know, I don't really have much in common with this person. And if the person you're with is not totally committed to Christ, there's a good chance that they will decide that they're not going to be totally committed to you during some of those times, especially if there's areas where, let's say, you're jealous and she wants to live a lifestyle that tends to make you jealous. Well, you need to, you know, that's going to be a problem.
She was
anyway,
totally innocent, and she's definitely one guy at a time. It was just a silly thing that happened.
Yeah. Well, brother, I can't take the time for the story because I've got my calls waiting,
a lot
of calls waiting. But
thank you, Steve. I love you. God bless you. God bless your show.
Okay. God bless you, Skip. We'll be praying for you.
Thank you.
Bye now. All right. Let's talk to Bella, or either Belle or Bella, from Portland, Oregon. Hello. Is it Bella?
Hello.
Yes, hello.
It is.
Yes, welcome.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call. I have a problem. It's a question I want to ask. Is masturbation a sin according to the Bible?
The Bible does not discuss it directly, okay? The Bible does not speak of masturbation as a... It doesn't list it with any of the lists of sexual sins. The Bible has a lot of sexual sins listed. It's not in the lists. But when a Christian decides about whether they should tolerate in their life a certain practice, one way to do it is to look and see if the Bible says anything against it. If the Bible does say it's wrong, then it's wrong. If the Bible says nothing directly about it, then there's other things to consider, like how does it impact other duties I have as a Christian? For example, Jesus said that a man should not look at a woman to lust after her. Okay? Now, presumably, I don't know about women, because I've never been inside the skin of a woman and thought with a woman's brain, but I know men, when men masturbate, they're generally imagining visual things, which would seem to overstep the rule that we should not look at a woman to lust. And therefore, even though masturbation is not mentioned itself, the mental actions that I would think would normally accompany masturbation seem to be among those things that are forbidden. There's also issues of self-control. The Bible says if we walk in the Spirit, that we will not fulfill the lust of the flesh, and that one of the fruits of the Spirit is self-control.
That sounds good.
You know, and so I think that if we're walking in the Spirit, we should be able to control ourselves and not fall into that. Now, I want to just say, in this, for the sake of balance, there's a lot of Christians I know Christian pastors and other Christians who have told me they feel differently about that. They feel that, you know, since the Bible doesn't forbid it, that maybe it's something that God gave to, give Christians, a pressure relief valve of sorts when they're under sexual pressure. I just have difficulty with that. It seems to me like if that was true, that the Bible would name that as God's provision for Christians to stay celibate. After all, when Paul said, you know, if you cannot marry, if you can't contain yourself, then it's better to marry than to burn. He didn't say if you can't contain yourself, well, then just here's this pressure relief valve that God's provided. He seemed not to know about that as an option, even though he certainly knew about that as a practice. I'm sure he knew as well as we do that people do those things. But he did not seem to feel that was God's provision for a person who is single. And Paul himself was single and celibate. And so if he was a married guy or a promiscuous guy, and he was saying, hey, people ought to be able to live without sex, then you might say, well, that's theoretical, Paul. Practice what you preach. But he did practice what he preached. So I don't want to make any kind of legalism on something the Bible doesn't directly speak about. But as I said, I'm not sure how a person would harmonize the practice of masturbation with the issues of avoiding mental lust and with the issues of self-control that walking in the Spirit requires. So those would be my That'd be my short answer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Because sometimes I can't get to sleep.
Uh-huh.
And I, you know, and I'm over 80 years old.
Over 80 years old? Well, I'll tell you what. I have known lots of Christians who tell me that they do that and they don't feel that it's wrong. And so I've got, I would not feel comfortable about it myself. But I'll tell you this. I would just say, take my counsel and other counsel from other Christians. You know, don't consider me to be the last word on the subject, because the Bible doesn't say directly. And I would, you know, I can't condemn a behavior that the Bible doesn't directly condemn. Mm-hmm. But I can say I think a Christian is much happier if they can live without that. I think their conscience will be cleaner. I think they'll have more of a confidence in God and more of a sense that they're walking in the Spirit. So that would be my recommendation. But once again, you won't find a direct statement about that practice in the Bible.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, sister. God bless you.
Okay.
Bye now. Well, let's talk to Lisa from Las Vegas next. Lisa, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's actually kind of a follow-up to an earlier call. I have a family member, actually, who was recently speaking with, and he used to attend the Kingdom Hall, I guess, for Jehovah's Witnesses.
Jehovah's Witnesses, yeah.
Right. He doesn't attend there any longer, but he still has a lot of their doctrine in his head. And so we kind of got into a discussion, you know, about how you're saved, and he believes that Jesus Christ is the Savior, but he does not believe that he's God.
Right.
And without, you know, getting into a argument with them, I really thought that was wrong. And that,
yeah, well, he is wrong. He is wrong biblically. But the view he holds is very standard Jehovah's Witness view. You know, I mean, even though he doesn't attend Kingdom Hall, he still carries with him the doctrines that they gave him about Jesus.
Right. How does that affect his salvation? He thinks he's saved. I have my doubts.
Well, I can't judge necessarily, because although the Bible does teach that Jesus is God, it does not list that belief. That is, it doesn't list the belief that Jesus is God among the things that a person must believe in order to be saved. For example, I don't know whether Abraham or David knew that the Messiah would be God. They knew he'd be sent from God. I don't know if they knew he'd be God in the flesh. And yet they believed, and it was counted to them for righteousness. When the disciples began to follow Jesus in Galilee, I don't think they knew he was God. They came to believe he was the Messiah and, as they said it, the Son of God. But I don't know if even then if they knew that he was God. They seem not to have known. In the upper room, Jesus was with his disciples, and one of them, Philip, said, "Lord, show us the Father, and that's enough for us." And he said, "Have I been so long time with you, Philip, and you still don't know me?" He said, "Don't you know that the Father is in me, and I'm in the Father, and so forth? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father." Philip apparently didn't know that. And yet, Philip had been his follower for 3 years and had been certainly a saved man. So what I'm saying is, I think that if a person does not know that Jesus Christ is God, that their belief is incorrect, that he truly is God, and they just don't know it. Now, why they don't know it would be more the issue. They've seen a convincing biblical case that he is God, but they still reject it because they don't want to believe it? Or is it that they have not yet seen that the Bible clearly teaches that? If a person doesn't, like when the disciples were following Jesus in Galilee and did not yet know he was God, it wasn't their fault that they didn't know. He hadn't shown them. He hadn't told them. They had to come to that understanding gradually, apparently, and later in their lives. But there may be many like that today who they want to follow Jesus, but they have not yet seen biblically that he is, that the Bible teaches he's God. And especially if they've been deceived by Jehovah's Witnesses or others who say that Jesus isn't God and have given them what appears to be a scriptural argument against it, they might have their heart may be right and teachable toward God or not. If a person is willing to learn from Christ and follow Christ, I think they can be saved, even if their theology is un, unformed and imperfect, just like the disciples when they left their nets and followed Jesus. Their theology was imperfect and not yet formed. But they were, you're not saved by what your opinion is about that subject. You're saved by being a follower of Jesus Christ, by being a disciple. Jesus said, if you continue in my words, you are my disciples indeed, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Well, knowing the truth is one of the privileges of being a follower of Christ, but it comes as a result of following him, and it doesn't come all at once. It's Jesus said, take my yoke upon you, which means become one of my disciples. And then he said, and learn from me. Okay, so we first become a disciple, and then because we are his disciples, we begin to learn from him. And when the disciples began to follow him, he began to teach them. But it's interesting how that even after 3 years of him teaching them, he had not yet told them he was God. They learned that later on, but it must not have been the most urgent lesson that he felt they had to know, which seems strange to us, because to us, knowing that Jesus is God seems like, you know, the ABCs of Christianity.
Right.
But it wasn't the ABCs as Jesus taught it to the disciples. I mean, they came to that knowledge very late, comparatively. So I'm not in a position to say whether an individual today, like a man who used to be a Jehovah's Witness, a man who is what we call an Arian in his theology, which is the Jehovah's Witness view of God is Arianism. That view existed back in the second, in the third and fourth centuries. And some Christians held it. I believe they were true Christians, but they were mistaken. And it wasn't until 325 A.D. at the Council of Nicaea that that view was officially declared to be, heresy. But just because it was declared to be heresy by a council doesn't mean that the people who had believed it previously were suddenly unsaved. It was an undecided issue in the church until 325, and it's still an undecided issue for some individuals, just as it was in the early days of the apostles following Jesus. It was as yet something they had not yet learned, but they were already following. And I think being a follower of Christ is what determines whether a person's a Christian or not. So your friend may just be deceived, but he may be very willing to learn, or he may be deceived and very unwilling to learn. That I would say if he's unwilling to learn, then he's not following Jesus. If he's willing to learn, then he could well be following Jesus, and he just needs to learn more about who Jesus is, just like you and I need to learn more about who Jesus is. We all do.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, that does help me a lot. I'll just keep praying about it. And okay.
Well, okay, Lisa. God bless you.
God bless you.
Thank you. Bye now. Okay, let's talk to Mario from Salinas, California next. Hi, Mario. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Let me turn off the speaker.
Yeah, we got some serious echo going on there.
There we go. Well,
it's still echoing.
Well, it's not me. I turned off the speaker.
Okay, well, that's a strange thing. Sounds like you're in a tunnel.
Sitting in the car.
We're getting some feedback, too. Are you on a cell phone?
Yes.
Is your radio on?
As a matter of fact, yes, it is.
You may need to turn the radio off. How's that sound?
That sounds better.
That's much better. Go ahead.
Sorry about that. The Bible talks about not forsaking the assembling of the brethren. To your opinion, is that referring to organized churches as we know it today, or could it be like the home studies that you do?
Well, they didn't have institutional churches like we have today in those days, so it wasn't referring to that. Assembling with the saints would refer to, I think, intentional gatherings with Christians. Today, of course,
such as you do.
Well, yeah, I would say that meetings in homes are intentional gatherings. If they're intentional gatherings of Christians, they're just as legitimate as meetings in a church building.
So would you consider the home meetings, such as you do, as a covering?
Well, I'm not looking for a covering. You see, Jesus is my covering, and the Bible never talks about us looking for another. The idea of a church being your covering is a man-made idea. It's not a Christian idea, not a biblical idea. But if you're wondering whether a home church is adequate, it could well be. It may certainly a home church may be more adequate as a real church than some Sunday morning institutional church meetings would be. It depends on what's going on there. If you go to a regular church, if we could use that term, on a Sunday, or if you go to a home church on a Friday or a Wednesday or, you know, some other day of the week, either of those or both of them could be a real church as far as God is concerned. And you're certainly, there's nothing in the Bible that says you can't go to more than one.
Right.
You know, you could go to both. But the thing is, either of them might not be a real church, too. That is to say, the meeting that you go to on a Sunday morning or the meeting you go to at home could lack essential elements of what a Christian gathering should include. It might lack real fellowship. It might lack, biblical teaching. It might lack true worship. I mean, there's lots of things that could be absent from those things. But I would say that in deciding, if you're trying to decide whether going to a Sunday morning institutional church is required or whether going to some kind of a home meeting would be an adequate substitute, I believe that, biblically speaking, home meetings actually have more of a biblical precedent than the other kind of church does.
Correct. One last thing, and then I'll get off. The baptism of the Holy Spirit with the evidence of speaking in tongues that Acts 2 speaks about, is there such a thing as, in your belief, of learning how to receive that, or does it come on instantaneously while one prays?
Well, in the Bible, there's only a few examples of it. There's like five examples of it in the book of Acts. And in all those cases, the Spirit came and filled people somewhat instantaneously or in a moment while they're being prayed for or while they were praying or something like that, or while they were listening to Peter preach in the case of Acts chapter 10.
Right.
But
so when somebody says that they can learn how to do that, is that biblically correct?
You mean learn to speak in tongues?
Yes.
I don't think so. I mean, it doesn't sound like that would be the same thing that the Bible refers to as the gift of tongues. I do believe that when you receive the gift of tongues, it doesn't have to remain static all your life. It can be that it would expand. That is to say, when you speak in tongues initially, it could conceivably be of a limited number of words, as it were, but as you grow in your spiritual life, it may be a much more a broader vocabulary, you know.
Yeah, couldn't the person claim also the same thing, the same principle in learning?
Well, in a sense, if you're learning something, that usually means you're studying it and understanding it with your mind and things like that. But speaking in tongues, by definition, it bypasses the mind. It's not a learned behavior. It's
right.
A gift. You know, it's
okay.
Like working miracles. It's not a learned behavior. It's a gift that God gives to some people, and some people have it, some people don't. Now, I suppose
thank
that somebody.
You for your time, Steve.
Okay, Mario, thanks for your call. I think some people who have gifts start out rather naive in the use of their gifts, and certainly as they grow spiritually more mature, their gifting is deepened and broadened and made more effective, perhaps, whether that's a gift of prophecy or a gift of teaching or the gift of leading or the gift of helping or whatever. You know, there's all kinds of ways in which we grow, I think, in our gifting. And that could also be true in the gift of tongues. But I wouldn't describe it as learning because it's not a learned behavior. It's something where your spirit prays, but your understanding is unfruitful, Paul said. Anyway, thank you for that call and for the rest of you who've called and for those of you who've listened. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are a listener-supported ministry, and if you'd like to help us pay our radio bills, it does cost a lot of money, and we don't have any sponsors, and we don't sell anything. So we depend entirely on people like yourselves to just feel led of God, if you do, to help us pay the bills. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find us also at thenarrowpath.com. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Those of you who come to our Thursday meetings in Aptos, it's canceled this week. Just wanted to let you know. My name is Steve Gregg. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow so we can continue our discussion. God bless you.